All right, one last time, would you please check your cell phone, make sure it's silenced, and help me welcome Adam T.
My name is Adam. I am an alcoholic. I want to thank the group. Thank you for inviting me. Thank Lee. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Thank my host, John. Welcome to people that are new. You know, if you're trying AA again, if you don't want to be here tonight, if you don't think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you, sorry it's come to this. You know, your sponsor made you come here tonight. I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. I had a couple of bad decades. And not to be funny, but for a lot of us, if you're new, this becomes a matter of life and death. Thank our first speaker. But, you know, I stood up for 17 years. I mean, the perpetual newcomer. I had so many chips and key tags. I remember one secretary saying, give them back, you know, and it wasn't funny. I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And looking back at that experience now, if you're new, I thank God for the unconditional love of the old timers. A lot of the old timers that aren't with us anymore. A lot of those old guys that died with 30, 40 years sober, and they watched a lot of us come in and out of the rooms. And, you know, they would say things to me like, don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. No, but in a loving way, right? But they made it really clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, because somehow I guess they could see it. They could see it by my demeanor. They could see it by my lack of interest. They could see it by my fidgety nature. I mean, I think from their experience, from the years of watching people come in and out of AA, maybe they could just see it by my attitude, that maybe it wasn't right now. But they were so kind, they were so gracious, they were so forgiving, they were so tolerant of my bad behavior. They were so welcoming. And they made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of AA would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think looking back at that experience now, if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the closest thing to unconditional love that an alcoholic like myself will ever experience. No matter how many people I burned, how many lives I destroyed, how many cars I wrecked, how many hearts I broke, how many jobs I lost, how many despicable, shameful things I did. And if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, it's the most shameful thing in the world to be the family drunk. Especially if you come from a large family like I do, where my mom had three sisters and a brother, my dad had three brothers and a sister, and I would be in high school, I would cringe. She would be telling them everything. The whole family, one more rubber room, one more overdose, one more car wreck. Happy birthday, Dad, I'm in jail. I mean, does anybody here relate to being paid not to come home on the holidays? It was horrific. I mean, they knew I would creep in right after Santa Claus, take everything. They didn't know what to do with me. We'd have relatives coming from all over the world. My family had, you know, we had relatives everywhere. And I'm in Mexico with some poor uncle's car. It was awful. And if you're new, probably for the first decade, the first 10 years of my recovery, I was completely unable to see through the lens of Al-Anon. The annihilation of everything worthwhile, the destruction of being an alcoholic. I mean, I was talking to a guy, just if you're new, we were talking about a friend of mine that's 30 years, right? Every day he would go to work, he would leave work, buy a sandwich, and come home. Every day, go to work, buy a sandwich, come home. Every day, go to work, buy a sandwich, come home. And his wife's watching him. And she says, honey, every day you go to work, you buy a sandwich, you come home. His wife says, why don't you buy two sandwiches? And he says, honey, I don't think I could eat two. That's the self-centeredness of an alcoholic. This is not a good dating pool. So for probably the first 10 years, I couldn't see it. Yeah, I was a straight-A student. I was the top of all my classes. I was an only child. My mom and dad were married over 50 years. And to look back now and watch those two souls that had all these hopes, all these dreams, all these expectations, they saved to put me in the best schools. And to watch those two people literally watch their only son burn his life to the ground, to the point where eventually my mom had sold the family property. She moved. She gave up. And she did not leave a forwarding address. That's where I left my mother. And despite all of that, if you're new tonight, the doors of AA have always been open to drunks like me. If I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay AA back for the love and kindness. You know what? Some of you people have shown me, not all. I mean, if you like everybody in AA, you know what it means? It means you're probably not going to enough meetings. My sponsor said, you don't have to like anyone in particular here, but if you go through the steps and the traditions, you'll learn to love people here you don't even like. People that are sarcastic, people that are condescending, people that are divisive, people that are difficult. I mean, AA is not the hotbed of mental health. And I don't mean to be divisive. But if I've learned anything in almost 27 and a half years sober, I've learned compassion for my fellow man. You can't go through the steps and go through fourth and fifth steps with people and hear the heartbreak, the desperation, the loneliness, the things that we go through, and not develop compassion for another human being. I believe it's impossible. And to learn how to not take things personally. So when I see that sarcastic, difficult, condescending, divisive person at a 7-Eleven pissing in his pants trying to get another drink, if you're new tonight, my heart still breaks for him. There is something very unusual if you're new about AA. I was talking to a guy before the meeting. It is the only place where the worse off you are, the better chance you have of recovering. And even more than that, that we want nothing more from you than to have a beautiful life, to reunite with your family if you even have one, to learn how to chase your dreams, to have relationships that work. And all that being said, all that great stuff, eventually I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about Alcoholics Anonymous 2026, if you actually see a drunk person in a nice meeting like this these days, people say stuff like, oh my gosh, what's he doing here? Ironic as it is, right? I mean, we don't see a lot of wet alcoholics in AA anymore, and I don't want to bash the therapeutic community. But, you know, for me, treatment would swoop me up in my most desperate moments, throw me into yoga class. I mean, they don't know what to do with me, the downward dog. I mean, come on. Really? Craft hour? I'm making belt buckles and bongs. It's ridiculous. I mean, all the therapy in the world. I mean, you know, first chance I get, nature walk. I'm walking to 7-Eleven, getting a big gulp cup, filling it up with liquor, putting a little Coke on top, walking back into the late night candlelight meeting, doing some of my best sharing. You know, then I start going through institutions. And it's funny, we have a chapter in the book, if you're new tonight, chapter to wives. Anybody read the chapter to wives? I never read it. I never had a wife. Not of my very own. I figured I'd stir it up for the Al-Anons. Hey, this ain't church. But I know. All right. If you got a halo, don't let it choke you. But the chapter to wives talks about these four types, and it really illustrates the progression of alcoholism. Fun with problems, just problems, right? Magic, medicine, misery. But that fourth type described in the chapter to wives is the type of alcoholic that's been placed in one institution after another. We've all seen it. Sound familiar? Type of alcoholic that typically drinks on his way home from the hospital, right? And in the 17 years that I recycled through Alcoholics Anonymous as a newcomer, in one of the largest AA groups in the world, I was surrounded by the wisdom of AA. I still became that fourth type. By the time I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times. Right, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times, and I'm wearing that like some kind of badge of honor. I'm thinking that's what makes me an alcoholic. And I remember telling my late sponsor, hey, I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would get rid of the guy, you know, loser. You know? I mean, I had one of those overzealous sponsors chasing me around with a book. I'm sure you got a couple here. You know, I didn't want to ruin his batting average. So he starts laughing when I told him that. And I said, you know, I don't think that's funny. And he says to me, you know, Adam, going through treatment 28 times doesn't make you an alcoholic. I thought, you're kidding. He says, oh, no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny either. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fat me up for another run. Treatment has its rightful place in recovery. Think about it. Even Bill Wilson had gone through treatment. Treatment probably saved my life. If you ever wonder what all the treatment centers and religions do have in common, it's kind of obvious. They all send their drunks here to us. Some people don't go through treatment. Certainly not a prerequisite for Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you're new tonight, my experience for me is that for me, treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like a lot of us, I always thought the problem was liquor. I thought it was alcohol. And I remember someone in Alcoholics Anonymous saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, that little glass of Chardonnay, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then he paused, and in the very next breath, he says to me, and if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, your problem is an alcohol. And I'm like, what? It went right over my head. In fact, it took another decade of suffering for me to understand the impact of that statement. It was almost like some kind of cruel riddle. I dragged over that for years. But what happened? I mean, if you're new, you'll hear that a lot. What happened? Just like what happened to Ebbie Thatcher when he came back and visited Bill Wilson. And Ebbie had been Bill's lower companion. He was a mess. And Ebbie came to visit Bill, and Bill observed that he was inwardly reorganized. Something had happened to Ebbie. And what happened to me is I got around a group of big book literalists, enthusiasts, people that took the statements in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, turned them into questions, and directed the questions at me. Very simple ideas. Like, was I incapable of being honest with myself? Did I, in fact, drink because I like the effect produced by alcohol? Well, duh, that's a no-brainer, right? How about this if you're new tonight? Could I be or was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Was that my natural state at rest? Very powerful question. Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking at the same time? And the evidence, which is really the proof, did I pursue that illusion, meaning just out of reach to the gates of insanity and death? And if you're new tonight, what happened to me when I went through those considerations is for the first time I saw the truth. And the most obvious truth, what we call the external unmanageability, was crystal clear. From my time I was in middle school, I remember being in eighth grade. I'm a little kid. I'm already pissing in my pants. I'm already drooling on my desk. I was already passed out under the bleachers. I overshot the mark from the very first time I drank. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People are picking high schools, right? I'm already picking rehabs. But if you're new tonight, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or six packs or 12 packs or kegs or shot glasses or little glasses of wine. Alcoholism comes in people. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering in my mind, if going through the considerations in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous shows me anything at all, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, an alcoholic of this type, cannot really live without alcohol, not successfully, not happily. And part of what it seems to mean for me to be an alcoholic, if I'm honest about my relationship with liquor, is that I have a mind that will consistently take me back to that first drink. Every time I get released from an emergency room, a hospital, a fancy Malibu treatment center, right? Men's Central Jail, 5743, roll it up. It's amazing to me. I've been in county jail, men's central jail, more times than I can count. And I'm sitting in my little cell on my cot, casually reading a novel, not a cloud on the horizon. And I hear that release number, 57431, roll it up, you're being released. And suddenly there's the compulsion in me, it's visceral, it is so powerful that I'm vomiting with anticipation on my way to the liquor store. And you think at that point I'm going to call my sponsor? The last guy I'm going to call. As soon as I hear that release number, this thing takes me. It's so powerful, I can't even stop at the release module for my property. And I come to AA, and people mean well when they say, well, don't drink no matter what. I'm like, what? No disrespect. What happened to the top of page 24 where it says verbatim, every alcoholic passes through the state where even the strongest desire is of absolutely no avail? I had to understand, I am not trying to be divisive. The doctor's opinion is crystal clear that some of us are entirely normal in every respect except the effect produced by alcohol. Normal, friendly, able people. That is not who I am. That even close to the description of what I am. This restlessness, this irritability, the need to keep score, the need to be right, the need to defend my mistakes in every area of my life. See, loss of control is the cover charge. It's a very simple idea. I got a car at home. It's got no brakes. I know the car's got no brakes. And you know what? I live on a hill. I know if I get in that car, I take it out of gear. I'm going to take out three or four of the neighbor's cars. I do it every time. Run that stop sign, bottom of the street. Take out a couple more, maybe, you know, a picnic bench. I know I got a car with no brakes. Now, my neighbors, they got a car with no brakes. They don't drive no matter what. Somehow they're able to do that. I'm like, that's fascinating. The problem with me is a little, I just want to sit in the car. All the places we went in that car, you remember all the places we went? Parked up on the hill, the romantic weekends, the back seat. I swear, if you gave me a lie detector test, I will not take that car out of gear. That is something very, very different. That's why we say, if the drink doesn't get you, the lifestyle will. See, loss of control is the cover charge for AA. That's half of the problem. Loss of choice is a death sentence. It means I can't stay out of that car. I do not have an effective mental defense. Not against the second drink. We all know that. That's obvious. And behind loss of choice is something even worse. It's called loss of power. The word power is used 25 times in We Agnostics. And if you're new, it means the lens through which I see the world is so distorted. I'm so broken that my own mother looks at me and says, for God's sake, son, drink. You were nicer. Please, you're tearing my house up. Have a cigarette while you're at it. And if you're new, my experience is unless I can develop that sense of comfort and ease that I'm seeking from alcohol through this spiritual way of life, a drunk like me will never stay here. I mean, alcohol, I hate to say it, it's classified right by the AMA as what? A depressant. 9 out of 10 people, they have a couple drinks and they're like, oh my gosh, I got worked. It's Sunday night. I'm beginning to feel it. I have a couple drinks and honey, I want to get married. Right? I have a couple drinks. I want to go to Vegas tonight. That's why tonight's tickets are $1,500. If you wait a week, they're $60. They know we're coming. I mean, I have a couple drinks. I'm trying to find the car keys I hid for myself before the first drink. See, for me, alcohol is a stimulant. Does this not sound familiar? It does something for me that overshadows everything it does to me. You know, if you're like me, normal people have a couple drinks, they start to feel out of control. I have a couple drinks and oh my God, I feel in control. It's like all of a sudden I want to go places. It does something for me. When I don't drink, I actually suffer. When I do drink, you suffer. And that's in many ways what the Al-Anons can't figure out about us. They can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why you don't. And I used to think, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. That's the half-truth. That's like looking at the tip of an iceberg and seeing the ruined marriage, broken home, financial destitution, the failing health, and thinking that's the problem. In fact, that's what treatment tells me the problem is. That's why I'm in another fancy treatment center in my nightgown, learning about my triggers. I'm like, excuse me, counselor, waking up's a trigger for me. I'm awake. They have no idea what to do with me. I mean, the state of the art now is they're going to give me a pill that's going to take away my cravings. My mom's like, can you give you a pill, stop you riding motorcycles and chasing women? It's like ridiculous. If you take booze away from someone like me, you have to give me something better. And everything about Alcoholics Anonymous is showing me how to develop this idea. And I know people mean well when they say it, don't drink no matter what. And I know for many people that's true. It's not meant to be divisive. But for someone like me, after being institutionalized all those years, there seems to be a very simple translation. Go to meetings no matter what. Work steps no matter what. Maintain commitments no matter what. Be of service no matter what. Develop this discipline of steps 10, 11, and 12, which is peace, power, and purpose. And so fascinating, Dr. Silkworth says, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, he says, once a psychic change has occurred, this very same person, me, is suddenly easily able to control my desire for alcohol. What a powerful thing that is. You know, we talk about, oh, AA has no evidence-based results. Really? Go to a world convention. Some of you guys were up there last year, standing there with, and that was a small one with 45,000 people. But when you see 45,000 people, if you do that third step prayer, you don't cry a little bit. I can't relate. I'm not a crier. But for every one of those people that made a journey like that, you'll see a beautiful mom, you'll see a dad, you'll see a son, you'll see a daughter, you'll see an uncle, you'll see an aunt, you'll see a world of people like us. And you can't do that on your insurance. You have to buy a plane ticket, conference ticket, hotel room. That one, you had to have a clean passport. You know, that's why there was only 40,000 people there. The other 30,000 couldn't make it. We know. We'll see y'all in St. Louis in 3 years. But Harvard and Stanford both studied AA. They said the same thing. The results of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous exceeds all the other modalities combined. The book is on the top 88 books in the U.S. Library of Congress that shaped America. Look it up. My sponsor said, in short, it doesn't matter who's right. It doesn't matter who's wrong. It just matters who's left. And when I look at people, I know, she caught it. But, you know, when you look at people like this, a place like this where, you know, I've got calls from some of you guys with like 20, 30 years sober that have great lives, that are chasing your dreams, that have relationships that work, that have learned how to navigate around the drama, that have learned how to match calamity with serenity, that have learned how to stay in fit spiritual condition. What happened to me, if you're new, is for the first time, and I was talking to a gentleman in the back in the bathroom, I became teachable. The longest trip for a drunk like me isn't from my head to my heart. Sounds great. It's from my knees to the ground. It is only from there, from that place of complete and absolute humility, that I can build a life worth living. And I had to understand that. I look back at 17 years of failure again in one of the largest AA groups in the world. And what I see is my defiance towards spiritual principles. The original manuscript in the book said, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions. Now, if you're like me, I don't like directions. Ask any girl I've ever dated. I don't like being told not to do something I already don't want to do, right? Sound familiar? I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Oh, and then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial's an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You can tell an alcoholic. You can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that means if you're new is you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. When we talk about attraction rather than promotion in the 11th tradition, what that eventually meant for a drunk like me is eventually I'll come back to AA on my own terms. Not because sober living wants me to, not because my parole officer wants me to, not because DCSF thinks it's a good idea. I mean, I live on the west side of LA. They all come in to save the trust fund. You know, we're like, that guy's never gonna make it, you know. Maybach. But see, hope doesn't matter to me until I'm hopeless. See, hope matters to me when I got $1 million left in the bank, brand new Harley, truck in the driveway, boat down in the marina. You wouldn't catch me dead in an AA meeting. And my experience, if you're new tonight, is that God didn't matter to me until my back was against the wall. And this isn't gutter bravado. I got shot a couple times. One time I got shot right through my chest, laying on this gurney. And I've got the paramedics around me with the paddles, and I'm still awake. And if you're new, I've never been closer to God in that moment. There's only two things men cry for in that moment, mommy and God. Right? Have you ever had your head in the toilet with the dry heaves puking up your esophagus? Remember that great feeling? Who prays more than drunks like us? Come on. And it's fascinating because Bill Wilson talks about having this powerful white light experience. And on the very next page, it says it was quickly blotted out by worldly clamors, most of which were where? Within himself. So I'm laying on this gurney. They stuck a tampon right through me. That's the way they deal with this. And all I wanted to do at that moment, suddenly it came to me. What a horrible person I'd been. And I wanted to tell my mom how sorry I was. I mean, it's funny, at the very end, when I really thought I was going to die, all I wanted to do was tell my mom how much I loved her. I had beautiful parents. And I wanted to tell her how sorry I was and how much I loved her. And they take me to the hospital, and I get in this ER, and there's a cardiologist there, and it's a big deal. And the cardiologist does a thing called an angiogram, where he runs this cord through my groin, and he pumps a dye through my heart, and there's a big TV screen. And I'm really scared. I'd never been more frightened in my life. And he looks at me and he says, "Oh, the bullet missed everything. You're going to be fine." And I went from, "God, I will do anything you ask." I mean, I was as humble as you could be at the very bottom of that totem pole. I will do anything you ask. In one nanosection, it's like, I need to get out of here before law enforcement shows up. And where's my bottle? Like that quick. That's how quick I go from, "God, I will do anything," that foxhole prayer. I throw in the towel like a prize fighter. And then suddenly I'm taking the towel back one little piece at a time. And if you're new tonight, the difference between the act of surrender that gets us to Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over again as newcomers, we all had that day. And the state of surrender that's keeping the old timers here is a completely different concept. It's almost like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. It's so beautiful, right? It's so effortless. It's so graceful. But we all know what that swan's doing under the water, right? He's paddling like hell. And if you're new tonight, no offense, we have a chapter in the book, Into Action. Anybody notice there's no chapter into feelings? Now, I know there's a couple therapists in the room, and I don't want to offend anybody, but, you know, there's a therapy out there, cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's expensive. In AA, it's one sentence. It'll cost you $2. I can't think my way into right living, but I can live my way into right thinking. There's a beautiful story in the back of the big book, and it's called The Keys of the Kingdom. And at the end of that story, she says, "Now there is a feeling of being wanted and needed and loved." And she says, in place of a bottle and a hangover, she'd been given the keys of the kingdom, see? And what I didn't understand is the circle and the triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most powerful symbols we have. And it was removed for copyright reasons. But its example would be, if there was a weight pile in this room here, and I lifted weights every day for 2 hours, would I get strong? Absolutely. Does it matter how I feel about it or what I think? So my sponsor and my home group said that circle and triangle, if you're new tonight, because this is for the new people, represents three ideas: contribute, belong, and learn. And contributing is service. The more that I'm of service, the more I feel needed. It's just spiritual math. If you take my relationship with God, my relationship with self, my relationship with others, and put it on a blackboard, it equals county jail. And I couldn't see that. And what's happening now is all of a sudden I'm being shown how to change that equation. The more I'm of service, the more I feel needed. That's the math. You go to a party early and you help the host set up the party. It's your party. Then you can judge the people that come late, right? And my experience is the more that I show up and belong, the more, we were talking before the meeting. I go to meetings like this I've never been to in my life. I'll come half an hour early, assign myself as a greeter. What are they going to do about it? Within half an hour, I know everybody in that meeting. See, I can't separate cause from effect. The more that I belong, the more I feel wanted. The more I uncover, discover, and discard that which is blocking me from God, 1 through 3, self through 7, 4 through 7, and others, 8 and 9, the more that I'm able to give and receive love. It just adds up like that. The steps bring me wisdom. The fellowship where two or more gathered bring me power, power that I don't have by myself. And by reaching back in my community, that last piece, altruistically being helpful to others, for the first time I can give and receive love. So when she said, "Now there is a feeling of being wanted, needed, and loved," I got it. It's something I wanted all my life. I searched for all my life to be part of a community, to feel protected by some kind of God, and more important than all of it, to be accepted by self, that centerpiece. Thank God we don't look like our stories, right? So what happened to me is I got to one more treatment center, right? 120 pounds, missing a couple teeth, dying of, you know, we look, a vision for you. You know, crawling into detox again. It's like this wrecked racing car, right? With like two tires, one shoe, and I'm in detox, you know, in my nightgown with my ass hanging out, judging the speaker. So funny. I mean, we're the only people that could be on the curb and still look down at the world, right? I get two speeds, grandiose and comatose. Yeah. I'm strutting around the detox bragging about robbing Brinks trucks. I finally did my four step. It was a bread truck. It was empty. It's funny because, you know, Harry Tebow said that about Bill Wilson. He talked about alcoholics and he said, the four qualities of an alcoholic are grandiose, sensitive, immature, and omnipotent. And those are our finer qualities. Right? Stick that in your next match.com. See if you get any takers. Say, by the way, I'm selfish, dishonest, resentful, and afraid, too. It's like, yeah. So I'm in this treatment center, and this woman comes in on an H&I panel, right? H&I, as you know, stands for hospitals and institutions. You know, it's a committee, brings meetings into prisons, detoxes, treatment centers, hospitals. We also call it homies and inmates, right? But and some of you guys that were locked up probably had H&I come in, but you know, it's a committee. It brings meetings into, like I said, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get to meetings. Our H&I is about 200 people. They meet once a month. If you're ever in LA, I'll give you my number. You can come. And they're fighting each other to get on panels to talk to people that don't care. But H&I probably has one of the lowest relapse rates in all of recovery. So this woman is on this H&I panel. We're in the detox, in the little circle, and she does her AA talk. And at the end of her talk, I remember this like it was yesterday, so powerful. She said, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, she said, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her, and I remember looking at the guy next to me, and I said, what a bitch. Because I didn't understand the impact of what she was saying. And what she said was, after that, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. See, that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender that each and every alcoholic has to walk. If you're new tonight, we can't give that to you. A lot of people die before they ever get there. And it's not desperation. It sounds great. But you know what fixes desperation? A $10,000 check from daddy. Right? Credit on a Sunday. Hopelessness is something very different. Hopelessness is sitting in a million-dollar house on a piss-soaked mattress with everything money can buy and knowing all by yourself, that loneliness, that there's nothing that's going to stop you. And that is the only point where I'm teachable. That gift of desperation is a great acronym for God. But for me and a lot of us, again, not God or bravado, I got to a place of entry. It was almost like my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take anymore. And if you've ever seen that kind of drinking, it's like I'm knocking on death's door. When my head can't get enough and my body can't take anymore, it's almost like God means something very, very different. It means grow or die. Then I'm faced with these two alternatives the book talks about, right? Go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. And what's the other one? Oh, accept spiritual help. It's fascinating. Faced with alcoholic destruction or to live on a spiritual basis, it says these are not easy alternatives. I mean, do a survey at Costco. You got jails, institutions, and death. Happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer. Now, if you step over to my cell in Men's Central Jail, you ask me that question, I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic death? Can I talk to my counselor, my therapist, my MFT, my parole officer, my attorney, and get back to you on Monday? And I will justify, minimize, and rationalize my right to get loaded. One of the definitions of codependency is to do something for someone else that they should be doing for themselves. Every one of those things eclipsed my ability to surrender, and I did not see it. That every one of those things somehow blocked me. The first half of step one, me defending my right to drink, the rest of my life defending my right to play God. And there's a beautiful saying, it says, God can't use a man or woman till they come to the end of themselves. And what I didn't understand, just like in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, he talks about it, this, do you really want to stop for good and for all? It's a very black and white, all or nothing question. And the other is, do you feel like you need help? And for me, my experience, if you're new tonight, is the bottom seems to be the same. If you've had the, I think it's a privilege of working with new people. The privilege of working with new people. It seems like the bottom is the same for everybody. From Yale to jail, Park Avenue to Park Bench, the elements of the bottom are very simple. It's when somebody like me asks for help, but more importantly, when I'm actually willing to receive it. Real simple. I throw you a life raft and you're like, I was looking for a blue one. What? I really don't like the way you threw it, bro. And it's so heartbreaking. This is the kind of conflict we have working with people. We're trying to offer them a design for living, a roadmap to spiritual success, a way of getting out of this insanity. And still I would defend my right to be right. If you're new tonight, we're the only people that want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. I mean, if you're feeling heroic because you gave up your big, you know, Saturday night in Santa Maria, Norcutt to hang out with us, this is the only place on God's earth where they'll applaud because you came in to save your own life. You thinking about drinking tonight? Beats the hell out of being in a bar or a dope house thinking about being sober. You're wondering when the miracle's going to happen? You're in an AA meeting on a Saturday night. Miracles happen. I was told my sobriety is God's gift to me. What I do with it is my gift to God. I was also told there are three prayers. The first one is, God help me, right? That's the prayer we say when we're under the bridge or when, you know, we're in complete and absolute desperation. The second prayer, God give me, greatest distraction on earth. But the prayer I'd never said was, God use me. And Lee calls me. Yeah. You want to drive 3 hours up to Central Coast? I'm like, yeah. And I couldn't be more grateful. Yeah, I got a friend here who came in. We were kids together. I would like drive into Tijuana from Los Angeles with an eighth of a tank of gas at 3 a.m. knowing I'd have a hose in the back so I could steal some poor guy's gas on my way out of Mexico. I did not care. That's who I am. I don't care. And now I'm like, oh, I can't make it to the meeting. I, it's like ridiculous. If you're new, you've got to make, my experiences, make this the most important thing in your life. The stronger the foundation, the bigger the recovery. That's just been my experience. All my life, what I would do, my sponsor said to me, he goes, Adam, there's a difference between being in the program and on the program. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, it's kind of like being in a submarine or on a submarine. When the ship takes a dive, you'll find out if you're in it or on it. Because I'm coming to AA. If you're new, I come here, right? Like, right, I get released from somewhere, and, you know, within like 60 days, I got a job, I've leased it all, I got a car, found a girl, right? And all of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous becomes terribly inconvenient. And the very things that AA gives me are the very things that destroy me. The shower I took yesterday won't keep me clean today. I can't stay sober on yesterday's program. My friend said it's like a cliff at your heels. Wherever you go, the cliff will follow you. If I get too far ahead of that cliff, I forget it's there. It's dangerous. If it's nipping at my heels, it's dangerous. But if I learn to stay in this sweet spot right ahead of it, by going to meetings, by working steps, by helping others, I develop a type of spiritual immunity, not just to the drink, but to the insanity that precedes the drink. The state before that Jim talks about and Fred talks about. That moment. And no disrespect. I mean, going through treatment 28 times, you know, I started to speak a foreign language in treatment. You guys know what it is, right? It's called victimese. Like, I don't understand how the drink bone connects to the jail bone. Like, I need a class for that. What are they calling that now? Oh, I heard someone talking about it. Relapse prevention. It's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. That's not delusion. Oh, my gosh. I knew he was a crackhead. Can't believe he stole my iPhone. It's horrible if you're in it. It's horrible if you haven't done the inventory. But what the inventory says is how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. When that was laid out in front of me, I saw the truth. And then I became proactive. Then I became preemptive. Then I was able to see where I painted the red flags green. Then I was able to see a new way to look at that. I was able to pause when agitated. What's the new word? Pause when deregulated? I mean, they get this all this new terminology. You know, it used to be a word called fear. Now we're calling it anxiety, right? Self-pity is called depression. Restlessness is called ADD. I don't have ADD. Anybody ever decide to go drinking and then forget? Please. I called the Coke dealer and forgot. Are you kidding me? I have like selective interest disorder. I don't have ADD. Sounds great. I got an irritability of my mind. Anybody got that? Quick to anger, slow to forgive, keep score in every relationship that I'm in. Anybody got the fault-finding mind? I got it first. I missed this exit. I was almost in San Luis Obispo before I realized what was going on. It was a blink. I came in here with a bad attitude. I got a discontentment of my spirit. This is the underlying idea. It means the shine wears off everything right away. This is who I am. I get a brand new car. I've been saving all year for the car. I don't even get it off the dealer's lot. It's the wrong color. 72 payments, a car I hate. Right? I get a new job. I'm making more money I've ever made in my life, right? Just doing the math. Getting ripped off. Come on. New house. Not even out of escrow. I hate the neighbors. And the dog. So I got something else going on. And I have to understand what really happens to people like me. A lot of people come to AA. They stop drinking. Everything works for them. They fit in. They're part of. Their career welcomes them back. They come to meetings once a year. Never work a step. And their life gets better. They've been serene since their ass hit the seat in AA. That's not my experience. My experience, every time I stop drinking, the first thing they say is, you know, man, you really need to be on medication. Why are you so angry back there? Why can't you sit still? What is wrong with you? And I'm crying at dog food commercials. See, when I'm not drinking, I have a whole nother set of problems. And if you're new, ask these questions of yourself. Now that I'm not drinking, am I still having trouble controlling my emotional nature? Well, I'm jumping up and down on some guy's hood in traffic. I think I am. Now that I'm not drinking, am I prey to misery and depression? This is sober. Now that I'm not drinking, am I having trouble with personal relationships? Hello? I was in an Al-Anon meeting. The guy goes, God put one arm over my shoulder and the other hand over my mouth. And I'm like, I get it. After that, I broke up with my girl 10 times a day and I never told her. Relationship was perfect after that. So I start to see this thing that happens to me. Now that I'm not drinking, am I full of fear? This pervasive idea of fear. Now that I'm not drinking, am I basically unhappy? And the way that plays out for someone like me in what we call untreated alcoholism is so awful. It's like I don't fit in. I'm not part of. You don't understand me. Everybody's in my way. Life's not fair. They're not paying me enough. I gotta drink. And I get in such a state that as soon as I pick up that cocktail, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Couple more drinks, pure fear of people and economic insecurity leave me, I'm buying the whole bar drinks. Right? Give me a couple Vicodin, I could comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. Give me a little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. See, and if you're laughing at that, there's something very wrong with you guys. See, alcohol produces the illusion that my life is manageable. Again, it does something for me that overshadows everything it does to me. And when we talk about a shift, just like that triangle again, back to the triangle, my head, my heart, and my feet. My head is the steps, my heart is service, my feet are meetings. If I can keep those moving in the same direction, what happens through this process is it starts to change my perception of reality. It's just that simple. You know, fear won't keep me here. Getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my career. Did scared straight work for you? Went right over my head. And it's interesting. The big book talks about the problem drinker and illustrates the problem drinker as someone that can stop or moderate given sufficient reason. Big difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. Think about it. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a drunk tank for drunk driving. Remember the rubber room? You got two completely different philosophies going on. You got the problem drinker over here on one side of the cell thinking, man, why did I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Why didn't I take Uber? Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, why'd I take the 101? Now, the court card people never laugh at that. That's not funny. Right? You should have stayed on Surface Street. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Problem drinker's wife says, you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. Problem drinker cleans up his act, gets a little Visine, does a drink in the house. If my woman says to me, honey, you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you, you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. And that's me. That's the selfishness. If anything got in the way of alcohol, it was out of my life. Alcohol was the love of my life, right? It had me from hello. It completed me. You think I'm going to let go of the love of my life without a fight? I can't even let go of a bad relationship. Everything I let go of has claw marks all over it. And if you're new tonight, my relationship now with AA is exactly the same. If anything gets in the way of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, it's out of my life. A woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how lovely she is, how pretty she is, my soulmate. I remember the first time I said that in a meeting, there she was in the back of the room. She's looking at me going, gosh, Adam, you don't look like an alcoholic. Why do you got to go to all those meetings, sweetheart? Oh, please, you're not speaking again, are you, honey? It's the weekend. Then she tells me, you know that AA program, it's getting in the way of our relationship. We've all heard this. You know, so we're still dating, and now it's the holidays, and it's the big night. You know the big night, meet the parents night. So the relationship's getting serious. She's got me at the head of the table, suit and tie. Out comes the exotic wine. Mom and dad are there, and she's like, honey, you can have one glass of wine. Wait a second, sweetheart. It's just a glass of wine. It's a toast. It's natural wine. Oh, yeah, four more rehabs. I stole her purse that night. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue. And she came to detox with a get well card. Poor girl. I think I got four cards from that one. I know, it's not really funny. I tried to send her to Codependents Anonymous. She wouldn't go. You know why? She didn't have anyone to go with. I can always tell the Al-Anons, they don't think any of this is funny. Can't stand to see us have a good time even here, huh? No offense. So my mom went to Al-Anon, and one day my mom comes home from Al-Anon, and she's like, you know, Adam, you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? I said, no, Mom. She says, none. The Al-Anon detaches and lets it screw itself. See you later. Horrible. God, I love that woman. So what happened is when I had about 5 years sober, I came back into my mom's life. And I'd done the steps. I'd done the traditions. I'd learned how to take the traditions off of this banner and apply them to our family. Our common welfare comes first. Our family, our relationship, whether it's romantic or familial, depends on our unity. That means anything that's divisive, because I have a fault-fighting, divisive mind, I have to watch it. Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? If it doesn't meet those requirements, the genetics loads the gun, the dysfunction pulls the trigger. If I don't understand both sides of this, you think Al-Anon doesn't matter? The big problem with AA, it's full of alcoholics. And when I started sponsoring and I started to understand these ideas in Al-Anon, I didn't cause their dysfunction. I can't cure their dysfunction. I'm not going to try to cure it. I'm not going to contribute to it, right? The four M's, mothering, martyring, managing, and manipulating. Once I learned those ideas, sponsorship became much easier. You know, did we have a genuine desire in the third tradition to be a family? I loved her. I couldn't stand in the same room with her. If you ever wonder why your family pushes your buttons, it's because they installed them. But it is not to play victim. Victims don't stay sober. What it was to take that button off my forehead, put it on a piece of paper, and learn to look at it from an entirely different angle. If you pet a lion, it's got a thorn in its side. Of course it's going to bite you. Every human being has a hidden thorn. Is it my job to point it out or pull it out? It is not. It is to live by example. And what happened is my mom became my very, very best friend. Because I discovered, like outside issues, where the emotional hotspots were, and I learned how to step around them. I discovered what she loved, like dancing, like history, like cooking, right? She was a music crazy. I have thousands of vinyl records right now that I got to sell somehow. And I built this relationship with my mom. My dad, my friend Stacy knows my dad. I hated my dad. He was never there for me as a little boy. And there's a part of the big book where it talks about we realized the people who offended us were also perhaps spiritually sick. And then it says, although we did not like their symptoms, column two, the way it disturbed us, column three, like ourselves were sick too. My sponsor said, to prove that statement, everywhere you have a resentment, you have to ask yourself, are you capable of the same behavior? So if I resent you for gossiping, did I ever gossip? Resent you for lying, did I ever lie? Resent you for stealing, did I ever steal? I resented my dad for abandoning me. He was never there for me. And the question was, did I ever abandon anyone I love for my true love, alcohol? And I had to let him off the hook. And there's a lie behind every resentment. The resentment with my dad is that his love for me should have been more powerful than his selfishness, than his alcoholism, than his dysfunction. And what happened when I did that exercise is I got to forgiveness. And if you're new tonight, forgiveness is releasing someone from the prison of my own mind. It has nothing to do with the other person. Behind forgiveness is compassion. Behind compassion is empathy. And when I went through that process, inadvertently at the same time, it was almost like what we call serendipity. My dad looks at me and he says, son, I'm so sorry that I wasn't there for you when you were a little boy. And what happened is my dad became my best friend. My friend here saw it for 17 years when he was diagnosed with dementia until New Year's Eve when he died. I took care of that guy. I gave him 1,600 showers. I did everything I could. I treated him like a prince. Every day was Father's Day for that guy. Because I realized when he grew up, at 5 years old, my grandmother was hiding him under tables while Hitler was bombing London. At 9, she died of cancer. He was all by himself. They put him out in the country to protect the kids from the bombing of London. At 14, they were taking kids. My dad goes to fight in the Korean War as a cadet. And I'm thinking this guy should treat me like Mr. Brady. The problem was he didn't have the ability. Just like if you're a first generation person here, a lot of times the cultures clash and we don't have the ability to see from their perspective. But I knew my dad would sit on a hand grenade to save me. He would do anything for me. And the last thing that old boy said to me, he said, son, I will love you forever. I wished he had told me he hated me. I could have believed that. But for Alcoholics Anonymous to bring my family together through generations of dysfunction. My mom's brother committed suicide drunk. My father's brother committed suicide drunk. I come from a long line of suicide, mental illness, and alcoholism. And to be all this way past that now, and to be the strongest link in that family. If you're new tonight, alcoholism is the only disease, when treated, that will leave the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. I'd have never believed that. So I'll say this last thing, because I know we're out of time. I get to fly a lot, and I was at LAX and I'm getting ready to get on this plane, and this guy comes charging me from across the terminal, and he's wearing a slingshot t-shirt, full body tattoo, the neck thing. I know some of you girls like that look with a teardrop until they start taking a swing at you. But this guy rushes me at the airport, and he gets me up against the wall, and he's like, "You don't remember me, do you?" I'm like, "Me? No, I don't remember you." And I thought he was going to hit me up for money. He's really aggressive. And he had these two beautiful little kids, and he had this lady by his side. And he looks at me and just completely blindsided me. He said, 15 years ago, you spoke on a prison panel, and something you said changed my life. He goes, "These are my beautiful daughters. This is my amazing wife. This is my family. We want to thank you." And the wife starts crying. The faucet's on, the wife's crying. Now the little kids are crying. Now I'm crying, right? A minute ago, I didn't want to take a swig at this guy or run. Now we look like the long-lost family from the old country. And I'm thinking, I knew I was a Dalai Lama. So I make the mistake of calling my sponsor. My sponsor's like, "Adam, you got a big mouth and a good memory. Don't let it go to your head." And he hung up on me. He had to, like, ruin my moment. But if you're new tonight, there's two dates in a human being's life: the day we're born and the day we find out why. All my life, I thought it was about money, property, and prestige. Job, house, relationship, car, different job, different relationship, more money. But see, puke smells the same in a Mercedes. If you got what I got, it's nice to have the stuff, but the loneliness, it won't fix. The lack of purpose, it won't fix. If irritability of the mind, restlessness of the body, and discontentment of the spirit is the problem, then the solution has to be peace in step 10, power in step 11, and purpose in step 12. Very simple idea. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, "What's the most important thing of all your teachings?" He said, "Love God with all thy heart, love thy neighbor as thyself. And if God scares you out of AA and you're a real drunk, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in." So in 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. And that 12th suggestion, right? The promises that come through there to watch loneliness vanish, to have a host of friends. This is something you should not miss. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam. Let's hear it again for him.